My name is Retha Gresham. I'm an alcoholic. Good morning, everybody. I wasn't sure I was going to tell the story of what it's like today about driving these drunks around Niceville. But that's what it's like today, part of it. I try to not make a big deal of this sharing experience. It's certainly a privilege and an honor to get to do it. And for my own ego, I pray that God will help me forget self, and I say that it's no big deal. But then when I hear that it's by divine appointment, I guess that's debatable. And in that respect, I would think if that's true, then I'm simply the instrument. I'm here because of a lot of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've met over these past, about 23 years. I came to AA August the 8th, 1968. My sobriety date is February 14th, 1969. So there have been a lot of people like you who've had input into my sobriety. They've watched me be happy, joyous, and free, and they've watched me suffer, as we all do when we show up for life, sober or not. And I'm so grateful for that, because by myself, I am nothing, and I could not be here. And so when you think of that, that's really mind-boggling when you think of the different lives. When I think of all of those different lives that have been a part of my life and have contributed to it, so that today I'm still breathing. That's really it. That's the bottom line. So I'm going to try to share with you this morning what it was like for me, what happened, and what I'm like now. And there may be some people here who have heard my story before. There would possibly maybe be one or two who might have been to that event last year that Mary Rose spoke about. I used to travel around a lot. I spoke at the Gulf Coast many years ago, and that's how I got so attracted to that part of Florida. And as I traveled around in the job I had out of New York, I used to wonder where I was going to retire to, and I was so attracted to the northwest coast of Florida that that's what actually came about. And I think it was the third step working in my life that allowed that to happen. But my story goes back to West Virginia. When people ask me where I'm from today, I start stuttering, because there's several places now where I can call home, actually. And but West Virginia was where I was raised by wonderful parents who had limited education, and they were, you know, in the coal mining fields. And if you know the Loretta Lynn story, and I'm sure most of you do, her story was like mine for a period of time. And I remember when the Coal Miner's Daughter movie was made, I was working in New York, and I had walked about three blocks down the street to see the movie. And when I came out, and by this time, I don't know how many years I was sober, a good many, and you know, and seeing that movie and reviewing my life and looking at where I came from and where I was and the gratitude, and the tears flowed, you know, walking up the block on to Park Avenue and 34th where I lived. And that gratitude, I hope I never lose that. I'm proud of my heritage. Now, we don't want to get so emotional so early in this story, do we? But Loretta Lynn's story talks about losing her father, and the time came many years later in my life than hers when I lost mine. And but I'm grateful for what I was taught being raised in the hills of West Virginia. And there's no better gift than my parents could have given me: quality, character, the right between right and wrong. And I knew those things. And My mother's still living. She was 80 years old this month. But anyway, being raised in West Virginia Hills, opportunities were pretty limited, and I had two ambitions. I wanted to graduate from high school, and I also wanted to be a career person. And that long ago, that was unusual, because women, and I'll tell you sooner or later how old I am. But in those days, really, young women determined that they were either going to be a homemaker, wife, mother, or a career person. Somehow I had ideas of doing both those things, and they both came about just because of, actually, I guess, the disease of alcoholism. I married a young man from my hometown who was, by his own admission, a full-fledged alcoholic. He had gone into the Merchant Marines and very quickly got involved with the heavy drinking Merchant Marines and told stories about being on Skid Row in New Orleans and New York and different places. And I listened to these that year that we dated. I didn't really know what all that meant, but anyway, we were to get married. And we had two children during the time of our marriage. My daughter was born while we still lived in West Virginia. We'd been married about 3.5 years. And the drinking was, from the time she got married, the real alcoholic showed up in that marriage. Now, there had been drunks and parties and stuff, you know, up to this time, and I knew, I guess there was a problem, but I guess I chose to ignore it. But then when Kathy was born, it was really bad, and by the time we'd been married 5 years, he ran himself out of town, you know, with barring from everybody and losing jobs and everything. And he couldn't wait till I got to Columbus, Ohio, because I was capable of earning a good living. And I knew that. But anyway, we were married 9.5 years, almost 10 years, and before the divorce. And in the end, the divorce came about because there had to be that final straw. And the divorce came about with 99.9% approval. He was the only one who didn't approve. His family, everybody, you know, for those two kids. Our son Rob was born after we had moved to Ohio. They were ages 2 and 6, and they were my life. And they were my security blanket, really, for a long time, even after I got into alcoholic drinking, because I was so duty-bound, and I loved these kids so much. They had to be first, no matter what. And I was, I guess, determined to do this my way. I figured those people in my office when I got a divorce would say, watch her, she'll get married and get somebody to help her raise those kids. Well, I was better than that. You know, I'd do this myself. And I did. When I needed more money, I got another job. And for the better part of 15 years, I worked 2 and 3 jobs, even during my lunch break at the insurance company. And somehow I was determined to keep this family together, and I was going to do for them what any two parents could do. And to this day, I don't think there's a parent living who loves their kids any more than I love mine. I also feel that the same is true of my two kids towards me. They adore me. And they are my investment, you know. I have friends who didn't get married, who didn't have children, who have nice bank accounts, and they travel a lot. My investment is in those kids, and I put shoes on their feet and clothes on their back. And my rewards are tremendous. I got to see the world in another kind of way in Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that amazing how things work out? So in Ohio, newly divorced, doing all these jobs, I think it was 2 whole years before I realized I was divorced. I was so busy just making ends meet. I love to pay bills, love to have the money to pay bills, because for so many years I struggled to make that work. And one of the owners of a local gas station asked me for a date one day. And I thought, yeah, I can do that. I remember what I wore. I'm great on remembering what I wore on special occasions. This must have been special because I still remember it. a lot of special occasions came about that I don't remember, by the way. I always wished I could. Every time I was getting ready to have a good time, I'd black out and then I wouldn't remember it. But anyway, pulled up to get gasoline this one day and was wearing a little brown polka dotted raincoat. He asked me out and I said yes, and he came to my house and he was a beautiful young guy. Had a yellow Angora sweater on and he was blonde and blue eyed and, you know, respectable looking. And so we went out and we ended up at his place and he passed out. He got drunk and passed out. And I was furious. And I don't know why I did this, but this shows the insanity was already there. I stole a blanket from his bed, his house slippers, and the booze that was left in the bottle. Put them in my car, drove home. Next morning, I saw this stuff, and I was really embarrassed and ashamed of myself. And I gathered up the blanket and the house slippers, put them in a paper bag, and drove them down to his station and apologized. You know, and he must have thought that in itself was weird. But you notice I didn't return the bottle. Kept the bottle. So there wasn't very much of that. Over the years, I dated some, but there was never anybody interesting enough for them to come ahead of my children, and that was my goal. And I was so busy trying to survive with them and do what I was supposed to do, and then opportunities business-wise were coming up over the years, and some changes were being made, so that I never did remarry. And it's out of no bitterness, no unhealthy feeling about men. I love men. I love men as friends. And I have a good number of friends in this program. And one of the greatest compliments that I have is that a lot of those men, AA people in my life, their Al-Anon wives love me too. And that's great. And there are a number of those. And I'm looking at two of them right up here. Anyway, my drinking, during that marriage, I drank along with the crowd, but I was always so busy, I never fell down. You know, I was doing the laundry, I was doing the cooking, I was serving the drinks, washing the dishes. Have a lot of identification with the Al-Anon spouses in this program, because with his drinking, it was so bad that sometime before we moved away from West Virginia, I think it had even gone back that far, I used to think, if I just run in front of a truck and get hurt a little bit so that I would become incapacitated, this man would have to be responsible because everything was left to me. And that was very, very sick. I hear those stories and I have a lot of identification, but if Al-Anon was around that time, I never heard about it. So the divorce and I don't know when it was that I bought my first bottle to have at my house, but it was a bottle of screwdriver, a pint of screwdriver drink that you can get at the local carryout. And I don't know if they have them here, but you like the 42-proof booze and champagne and stuff like that, wine stores. And so I bought that pint of screwdriver drink, and I never bought another one. The next time, it didn't have the orange juice in it. It was the clear vodka, 42 proof. And I didn't bother to put vermouth in this. I drank the driest martinis you can get, and that's straight out of the bottle. At the office, I guess on Sunday mornings, y'all don't expect anybody to be thirsty. this trip to the liquor store the first time, I knew before I went that once I went, I'd be back again. I just knew that. Once I did something that was against my upbringing and all, I knew that it would just be that much easier to go back again. And I I, over a period of a very short time, I'm sure, found about 4 liquor stores within the radius of 4 miles from where I lived and worked. And I try not to be seen too often, but I still was seen too often. But I'd go to one liquor store one time, and I got to the point where I was drinking around the clock, I think, pretty fast. And as this was happening, I was aware of a story I'd heard years ago in Ohio about somebody who was, lady who was secretary, thank you, Jim, to the prosecuting attorney in our town. Everybody knew that she carried a bottle of booze to work with her. And as I did this and started doing this, I remembered her. And there were some clues along the way that I had for myself that I knew I was in trouble. But it just wouldn't register deep enough where I just didn't really want to know the truth. For instance, when my ex-husband, when the divorce came about, he didn't take the big book. We had gone to AA meetings, I neglected to tell you that, for a couple of months. And he was one of those people, I think, who didn't stay long enough to hear enough to make the right decision. I always like to remember to suggest that to newcomers or anybody who's not sure they belong here. You know, stay long enough to hear enough to make the right decision. But we had gone to those meetings, and so I knew about AA. But when I needed help, the thought never occurred to me. Never occurred to me. I don't know if it was because I was so determined and so strong in my own will to keep this family together and not to bring any more harm or disgrace to them or what it was, but somehow buried subconsciously in my mind was some knowledge about AA. At some point, I had started having lunches with the office gang, and I learned to like martinis. I thought that I drank them because of the large green olives. And later, I resented the size of the olives. And that was where I was getting to, you know, the driest martini you can have is the one straight out of the bottle. And I would drink them straight out of the bottle. The only time I put them in the glass when I was in the house is when I wanted my kids to think I was drinking water. And I'd have a tall glass on the back of the sink, you know, when I'd be working around in the kitchen. And from time to time, I'd want to change it. My Uncle Bill, he was an uncle from the marriage, was devoted to my children. He'd come by my house sometimes on his way to pick Aunt Edna up from work, and he'd bring a pint of vodka. And he always brought the 103 proof stuff. We'd have 2 drinks, he'd go on, and then he'd leave the balance for me. And it may be under the ice box, you know. It was a good place to ice trays to have it, or a bottle I had been had under the seat of the car, the parking lot, in 105 degree heat all day. It didn't matter which, I still drank it out of the bottle. Didn't bother, but sometimes I'd get confused when I'd have this glass on the back of the sink. I wouldn't remember it was the 103 proof, but because I filled the glass up when it was 42 proof, you see, I was just, didn't matter how strong it was or how weak it was, I drank it all. And that's my story. That's really my qualification about drinking. I always saw the bottom of the bottle. I wasn't smart enough to save some for tomorrow. As long as I was standing, I took it all. I used to think if I had more money and if I could have a really big supply in, I wouldn't drink at all. You know, that's why I was an alcoholic. One of these part-time jobs I had was working for a local pharmaceutical company. And all those goodies that the people get into today, you know, I packed them by the thousands and 5,000s out of huge barrels, put them in a machine, whizzed them around, counted them out. Didn't know how good those were going to be for folks down the road somewhere, you know. Thank God I didn't. For some reason, I had a tremendous respect for medications. I guess it was because maybe when I had gone to work there, I met this man, my good friend Lee, through the lady I'd met in AA, who was later to 12-step me into the program. But I met her when my husband was going, and I had gone with her somewhere to some lady's house to clean out the pills, and the woman was in the hospital NDTs. And then she told me about some other lady who had killed herself. She had worked for Lee and stolen 1,000 phenobarbital or something and killed herself. So I went into working for him with that tremendous respect. So thank God I never got onto pills. I don't like them today. I'm the only woman I know my age who doesn't take anything. Aspirin for a headache occasionally. I'm just blessed. You know, I'm just very lucky. Well, I'm having to take something for my breathing now. That story, I got to change that story. Recently, I've had to take something for the breathing. Anyhow, alcoholism and crossing that line we hear about. You know, I was thinking earlier that I don't know when I crossed the line of alcoholism, but isn't it a neat thing to know when you know you crossed the line into sobriety? And you've got that, and that's our sobriety date, and to hold on to it. The time came when there was a crisis going on in my life, and I was drinking round the clock by now, carrying it to work. Had a very respectable job, secretary of the president of my company, and given a lot of responsibility outside and inside the office. And he and his wife went away on a vacation. They came back, and he was found to have cancer. Now, I had a tremendous hang-up about death. Never knew where it came from, but could not go to a funeral and pay respects. To see a funeral procession out on the streets, I cringed from it. I never knew where that came from, and it was some emotional maturity that I was able to get in this program. Today I can handle that, and I can go in and go with myself and pray the Serenity Prayer, you know, and what tremendous growth in that area alone. But then I didn't know how in the world I was going to handle this, and I went to our company medical director, and he didn't know I had a problem with alcohol, but he prescribed some nerve pills for me. And so I went to my pharmaceutical friend Lee to get the prescription filled, and he knew the dangers of mixing alcohol and pills. So he, a non-alcoholic, made this phone call to Hazel, the lady that I had met 10 years earlier when my husband was trying the program, and she called me, and she said, "I understand you might have a drinking problem." Her reputation is for being tough love all the way, and I said, "Who says that I do?" She says, "Well, Lee thinks you might have." And I heard myself say, "I ought to be really mad at him, but I'm not." And I didn't know I was going to say that. I knew if Lee went that far to make a call to this woman, that he took it at the risk that I'd never work for him again. And he did it because he cared for me. And I thought I knew how it worked. So I said, should I go to a meeting with you? And she said, "No, you come over to my house and we'll talk about it." See, she didn't come to my house. She had me come to her house. We know you do a 12-step call the other way, but she did it that way. I dressed for the occasion, and I thought as I drove 15 miles over to her place that when she saw me, she might say, and heard all the stuff that was going on, she might say, "Why, you poor thing, no wonder you drink." But, of course, she didn't say that. I like to remember to tell this because I think it's symbolic of what has happened over a million times. Who knows? 2 million? Who knows the number? God himself. That scene where the recovering alcoholic is sharing with the still suffering alcoholic, and only in the way that only we can do, because we've been there. And when we say, I know how you feel, no matter how long we've been sober, we still do. We know that desperation, the hopelessness, the remorse, the guilt, and the contemplation of suicide, and just nowhere else to go. And inside, I knew I was a good person. And I probably would have attempted suicide. I got very close to it several times, except those kids were always there. And as bad as I thought I was, and I did a heavy trip on myself, I was still the best those kids could have. My mother, my sister, nobody could love them as much as I did. So I had to keep breathing, as tough as it was, and showing up for life, you know. And the way I did it was with alcohol. It allowed me to show up for a long time. And then, like, one day it didn't work anymore. You know, this game was over, and I didn't even know it until I got that phone call. I had had a realization of a kind, and I guess it was really my taking the first half of the first step without knowing it. Every day was the same. Every work day was the same. It started and ended with drinking. The weekends were the same way, except different scene. Sundays were terrible. Sundays I almost never had anything left, unless I had just passed out and accidentally left some. One of the sickest things I did, I always want to remember to tell this, I drank a lot in the basement, and we had the cleanest clothes in town, because I washed them over and over. I'd go to the basement, and it was a long room, the size of the whole house, and some old couches and chairs, and then the laundry room down to this side, and the ironing board up, and I'd get desperate, and I couldn't find anything to drink, and maybe didn't even have any money to go get any, and I'd go to the basement and round up all those empty bottles, line them up on the ironing board, and then I'd stand there, and I would suck the corners for drops that I could get out of maybe 12 or 13 bottles. I'd come back later and try it again with the same bottles. Now that's desperate drinking. Where was it until I got to that? The Hazel, and so I thought I knew how it worked, and she had me come to her house, and then we made a date to go to a meeting. My first meeting was on a Thursday night, the Hilltop Group in Columbus, Ohio. And I also forgot to tell you, back up just a second here, that table, that breakfast table in Hazel's kitchen, when she called me, when I went over to be 12-step, filled full of grapevines. And she gave me the 25th anniversary copy of the grapevine, the silver cover. And I didn't know how symbolic that was going to be of my sobriety either. So anyway, went to that first meeting, and I wore a black raincoat, and I wouldn't take it off because I felt bad. I felt dirty, tacky, and hopeless. Somebody said something to me about taking my raincoat off, and Hazel said, she doesn't have to. This is an individual program. Sometimes she said kind things in my behalf. A lady spoke, and I couldn't have told you, I don't think, the next day what the lady said, except that I felt the warmth and everything of a meeting room that you've heard and experienced yourself. But what I did take home from that meeting were the words that somebody had written on a green chalkboard. The words said, hope is found here. And that's been mentioned, I think, already this weekend. But that's what I took home with me from that first meeting. hope. And I have been able to take hope home with me from every meeting I've attended since then, maybe sometimes not consciously. But if I show up a meeting and do nothing but warm a chair and say the prayer at both ends of the meeting, it's been a successful meeting for me. Now, it's more successful if when I'm really listening and I identify and I take all this good stuff with me that I can use at a later time, and that's happened over and over and over too. The right time, you know, it'll seem like the information pivots forth in my head that I need for a given situation that may seem totally impossible, but it has worked. I loved AA from the minute I got in. I really did. I didn't want to miss any of the meetings. And I didn't realize at that time that if you stayed in long enough, you could hear a lot of the speakers over and over and over again, as we do in our small towns. I remember going to my first meeting by myself. Hazel, I knew, was going to extra meetings because I was new, and I knew she liked to play poker on Saturday night. So I let her off one Saturday night, and I went to my first meeting by myself. And the chairman was kind of slap happy, and I used to tell this story in his presence all the time. He'd start the meeting, and he hadn't given the reading assignments, you know. I came into that meeting and I met two guys from my Whitehall group, Bob and Bob, so I sat with them. Jack started the meeting and he's fumbling around with papers and he said, "Oh, I forgot to get anybody to read how it works. Here, you read it." I was active in the program 2 weeks. And again, I remember what I wore. I had a big gold sweater with a big moth hole in it, and I trembled from head to toe. I mean, but I did it. I stood up and did it. And you know how long it takes a newcomer to read that whole front page, and you get to the bottom and it says over? And then you got to read the other side. Oh, God. But that has meant so much to me because I don't know which meeting it was, how long I'd been coming, until one day I really heard this message. It was a challenge for me out of how it works. It said, if I was capable of being honest with myself, I could be a part of this program. I could get sober and stay sober. And I knew it depended on me. I really knew there were a lot of people to help, but I had to be responsible for my own sobriety. And it told me how to do it. Here are the steps we took. We hear a lot of speakers who get into the steps and spell it out for us. And I think that for those of us who miss that, may stay sober, a lot of us may stay sober, but to really feel the serenity and have the sobriety that is offered to us through the steps makes it much more enjoyable and I think probably for most of us more lasting. We have a group in Niceville that is strictly a first step group, and that's a group I joined when I first went there. But that's not all. I can't have just that. I need to be in other meetings where I'm into discussion topics, where I've got me in it. And I don't need to be doing this kind of thing too often, and I don't do it too often. I don't need to be sponsoring great numbers of people. I need to sponsor as many as I can that where I can do it the way that is best for all of us. I don't need to count the number of people I sponsor. You know, I need to be able to do it so that I can do it effectively, hopefully. I don't know how I got into that, but I'll back up now. Going to the meetings and then getting involved in service. Hazel really did guide me along, and this is long enough ago that they were saying, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth, listen. Newcomers weren't, I couldn't talk until she told me not to speak up at a meeting until she gave me permission. And when a member of our group chaired our home group meeting wanted me to speak, I was 5 months. He had to get her permission before I could speak. And you know, that worked for us then. And there was a lot of stuff that I learned in those days. I'd like to hear more of it in the meetings now. But some of the slogans just saved my life over and over again. This too shall pass was one of them. Let go and let God. And every time I get a bumper sticker for my car, I think I'm going to get something different. And I keep getting let go and let God. And I guess that's what I need mostly in my life. This tremendous power that has worked in my life, all those years when I was drinking, to the time when I was able to get sober, and has continued to work for me. You know, there's a reason why I'm still breathing. And there have been times when it's been real tough to keep it up, I tell you. Somebody wanted me to get involved in service, and I did not want to get involved in that political stuff, that organizational stuff. This lady was serving as the alternate delegate, as the secretary, and she wanted to stand for alternate delegate, and finally convinced me in her second year of trying to get me that they had nobody else with my talents. Why didn't I come to assembly and stand for secretary? Well, they had nobody else, and so they elected me right off. And I thought maybe I didn't have enough sobriety, but I had 4 years, and they said yes, that was enough. During the 2 years that I served, we had a delegate who believed in delegating, and I got to do a lot of things in addition to the secretarial work, which was tough enough. But we had a conference to put on that year. We hosted the Ohio State Conference, and we had, in my second year, I guess that was, and I had some tough luck. The lady who was elected alternate delegate drank again, and our chairman died, and our state treasurer, I mean our area treasurer, borrowed our state conference funds, over $5,000. And I was getting all the phone calls on my job from the hotel, wanting to know where the money was. It's a sad story because we put our members in those positions a lot of times. They hadn't learned yet that you ought to have two signatures on a check. And I'm sure this man really did borrow the money, thinking he could pay it back, but things don't always work out the way people planned. And the saddest thing about it was he never came back to AA. So I believe we ought to ask our treasurers to give reports and not put our people in those positions. Anyway, when they looked around for people to stand for delegate the next term around, I had just gotten there and I was not interested. Now, I have to tell this because it's the truth and it's a part of my story. I don't think this is the ideal way to become a delegate, but it happened to me. Just because of the lack of experience on the area committee that had fallen by the wayside. So there were other people who stood, but they elected me, and I went to the conference, and I was 6 years sober at the time. Now, there were other people there who were 6 years sober as well, so it wasn't like I was the only one. And I worried so much about whether or not I was really qualified. I did not want to stand. Somebody asked me, Big O, somebody asked me to stand for chairman. I said, I can't. I don't have enough experience. Saw Big O at a Saturday night meeting, and he said, Retha, will you stand for delegate? And I said, no, I don't have enough experience. He said, Retha, if you get the job, you'll know what to do with it. You know, closed case. So they had me. Anyhow, I went to the conference and was fortunate enough to be assigned to the conference grapevine committee. And also, when I started hearing the ask it basket questions and some of the things that were being raised by these other delegates, see, I figured everybody there was better than me, knew more, etc. I realized I knew as much as a lot of them did. In fact, more, I would have known not to ask that stupid question. But it was a wonderful experience, and You know, God had to have been working in my life for that to happen. I didn't seek that out. These are the things that happen that you cannot make happen if you are of such control or try to be. And I was with the grapevine about 10 years, and it is, I wouldn't give anything for the experience. The reason I was able to handle it, I think, was that I had good sobriety in my own estimation. And if I don't have good sobriety, I don't think it's wrong to say that you do have it. You know I do, because I feel good about me. And I know where things lie. You know, you can work from inside out or outside in, but in the end, I go to sleep with me every night. And my head goes on that pillow, and I don't have any trouble sleeping. You know, so, but there were difficult times business-wise, and certainly there's a mixture of personalities and everything, but overall it was a great experience. I got to do a lot of traveling, met a lot of people like you in a lot of different places. And working at an AA job, I think you need the program there more than anywhere else. It's got to be as good as it can be because of being able to use this knowledge we have of our traditions and concepts of service and fairness and knowing how the committee system works and the checks and balances and the principles we learn in AA, the very same principles you in your groups with your own group conscience, that works throughout the whole of AA. And it's only because that really has held up over all these years that we're as healthy as we are and that the program is today the same as it was from the time they wrote our steps, and that people can come in and participate and have a voice and be a part of the whole. I don't know if that confuses anybody or not, but it's kind of what I'm in tune with, having gone through those years of service and the service working years. And it does work. There's not one of us who can mess up AA. Isn't that great? Not one of us, as bad as we can be, can mess this up, because as good as we are and as bad as we are, we all come together and in our own opinions, hopefully, do what we think is best for the for AA, and then God's there telling us what the real answers are. And they'll either come today or tomorrow or in God's time. So, great experience doing that. When I came back from that, I'm going to try to round this up real fast now. There was a reason why I came back. I wasn't sure exactly what it was God had in store for me, but I believe in the third step. Two main things. Had a nephew, Stevie, my sister's youngest boy, who had been in trouble with alcohol and drugs from the time he was 12 years old. They thought his dad was going to die any day from a very rare disease that he had, and everybody was looking more at the father than at the youngest child. And the youngest child was going to a psychologist getting drugs, and from there he got hooked and got very involved in drugs and alcohol. And he had been sent to several treatment programs. He was in the Kids Helping Kids program and other things. And when I came back to Ohio, Stevie was in the hospital again, and all of the kids called me Aunt Wee Wee because they couldn't say Retha. So Stevie loved his Aunt Wee Wee, and he wanted me to come and see him, bring him cigarettes. And my sister and her husband they'd gone to Tough Love, and they were having to say no. And I went to see him, and he came and lived with me for 9 months. Same time, my mother, there was a whole situation with my mother that I won't get into, but I needed to be in Ohio at that time. And my sister went into a mental hospital for treatment for about 3 months when all this was going on, and there was nobody there for Stevie. And if he hadn't been able to come and live with me, he would have been on the streets again, and I just knew it would be the end for him. So we had a wonderful time for about 9 months or so, and then some other things happened. I moved to to West Virginia for a job that I kept for 3 months, and then on down to North Carolina to work with the Department of Corrections for a couple of years with Tom I, many of you know. And in the meantime, Steve had found other places to live and everything. Last year, he came down to visit me with my daughter, and they were down there 10 days. We had a wonderful time, and he was healthy the whole time he was there. He's a beautiful young man, brilliant, fine mind, and I put him on the plane August 6th, October the 6th. They said he committed suicide, and he had run into a big bridge abutment there in Columbus and was gone. I've had a real hard time accepting that. I believe in God. I know that God's will has to prevail and that I don't have to understand it. But as far as trying to hold on and make something be different, you know, with Stevie, that has been, of all the things that have happened, the most difficult. And I just prayed that God would hold him in his arms, you know. That's the message, though. Some of us don't make it. I got active in the prison groups down in where I live, Okaloosa Correctional Institution. They have two meetings on Wednesday night, and I'd look around those young guys there and think, God, I wish Stevie was here. You know, in those years he was living, we were afraid that he would end up there, but that he would still be breathing. You know, this is what I've said a lot of times when I'm sponsoring people, or with people who just think it's hopeless for another alcoholic. Are they still breathing? You know, if they're still breathing and you can get them to a meeting, you have a chance. There's a chance. But I do have to believe in God's will, whatever that is. I'm not real clear on what's his will and what isn't in a lot of cases. You know, it gets very confusing for me. But I don't have to understand it. My most important job today is, number one, to continue to believe in this God that works in my life and try to give this message away whenever and wherever I can. And it can be in that little cab driving around in Niceville. Now, I did this to have some extra cushion money, you know, to go play around some of the year and drive some of the time. But I meet some people that I can 12-step, and one of the things I get to do is pick up the prisoners at the federal prison and take them to the bus station or the airport. Maybe they're going on furlough. Maybe they're they're out for good. And I carry around these lighters one day at a time, and easy does it, and I know how to talk to them when they get in the cab. Starting a brand new chapter today, huh? You know, and we get into conversation, and away we go, and I do this, and I hand them a lighter, and I say, lady, you know what that means to me. Yeah, I do. It has for 22 years, you know, and they like that. Anyway, I feel like I've rambled, and I know everybody's eager to get home, and isn't it nice that the rain has stopped? This has been a very good weekend for me. I've made some more new friends, and I expect to come back. I don't, you know, coming home was referred to. I think Betty Rose said it, and every time I go to one of these and come to another one, whether it's this one or another one similar to it, I'm coming home, because this is where it is, where the sobriety is and where so many people have shared with me, and then I'm given the opportunity to share sometimes. I appreciate being invited to have this opportunity to share with you, too. I just like to close this off in a way that I've done a lot of times, with a story from my coal mining days when before we moved away from West Virginia. I worked in an office, and there was a man there who was about to retire, and I don't know why he brought this up. It was something to do with him, not me, I think. He said, remember, Retha, that you're fast becoming what you're going to be, And I knew he was looking over the years of his life. And over the years, I would see people destroying themselves or really doing things to make their lives meaningful. And I'd think, fast becoming what you're going to be. When I came to AA, it came back to me for me at that time. And I look back at the time when I'd started drinking and so-called socially, and I didn't know it, but it was going to be a mad, fast slide down to that invisible line, and I was fast becoming what I was going to be, full-fledged alcoholic. Came to the program, saw those steps, and knew that for the rest of my life, whatever I was going to be could be with those steps. And fortunately, these 22 years have seemed like all of my life somehow. It hasn't been that fast deal, as referred to in the other part of this, but my life can be a good life with the 12 steps of this program. So if there are any of you who are considering drinking again, or you get into any kind of trouble and you want to give it a second thought, just remember that you too are fast becoming what you're going to be. Thank you, and have a good, safe trip home.